"Clearly, I am under great obligation to Mr. Rowan," said Graham, looking through the other pages with a melancholy air. "But I am ashamed to see that as I was dragged through the surf, I did not distinguish him as clearly as I should have done. Is he indeed the very cheerful, round-faced, black-eyed gentleman, somewhat positive and absolute at table, who so often laughed and gambled among the ropes with the midshipmen?"
"Himself."
"Aye. Well, I shall do what I can for him, of course, though the correction of verses is a thankless task."
Graham shook his head, whistling in an undertone and reflecting that perhaps being rescued was an expensive amusement. Then he smiled and said,
"Speaking of midshipmen reminds me of young Milo of Crotona and his daily struggle with the bull calf, and of his particular friend the tow-haired boy Williamson. Pray, how do they come along, and how does the bull calf do?"
"The bull calf now luxuriates in whatever part of the vessel may be appropriate, eating the bread of idleness, since it has become so much a part of the ship's daily life that there can be no question of slaughtering it, nor even of castrating it, so that in time we shall no doubt have a very froward guest in the Worcester's bowels. Yet it is Mr. Williamson that gives me more immediate anxiety. As you may have heard, mumps is got into the ship, brought by a Maltese lad in a victualler, and Mr. Williamson was the first and most thorough-going case."
Mr. Graham could never have been described as a merry companion. Few things amused him at all, and fewer still to the pitch of open mirth. But mumps was one of these rarities, and he now uttered an explosive barking sound.
"It is no laughing matter," said Stephen, privily wiping Graham's saliva from his neckcloth. "Not only is our Hamlet brought to a halt for want of an Ophelia, for Mr. Williamson was the only young gentleman with a tolerable voice, but the poor boy is in a fair way to becoming an alto, a counter-tenor for life."
"Hoot!" said Graham, grinning still. "Does the swelling affect the vocal cords?"
"The back of my hand to the vocal cords," said Stephen. "Have you not heard of orchitis? Of the swelling of the cods that may follow mumps?"
"Not I," said Graham, his smile fading.
"Nor had my messmates," said Stephen, "though the dear knows it is one of the not unusual sequelae of Cynanchae parotidae, and one of real consequence to man. Yet, to be sure, there is something to be said in its favour, as a more humane way of providing castrati for our choirs and operas."
"Does it indeed emasculate?" cried Graham.
"Certainly, but be reassured that is the utmost limit of its malignance. I do not believe that medical history records any fatal issue, a benign distemper compared with many I could name. Yet, Lord, how concerned my shipmates were when I told them, for surprisingly few seem to have had the disease in youth."
"I did not," said Graham, unheard.
"Such anxiety," said Stephen, smiling at the recollection, "such uneasiness of mind, one might have supposed it was a question of the bubonic plague. I urged them to consider how very little time was really spent in coition, but it had no effect. I spoke of the eunuch's tranquillity and peace of mind, his unimpaired intellectual powers. I cited Narses and Hermias. I urged them to reflect that a marriage of minds was far more significant than mere carnal copulation. I might have saved my breath. One could almost have supposed that seamen lived for the act of love."
"The mumps is a contagious disease, I believe," said Graham.
"Oh, eminently so," said Stephen absently, remembering Jack's grave, concerned expression,
the grave, concerned expressions in the wardroom, and upon the faces of a delegation from the gunroom that waited on him to learn what they could do to be saved. And smiling again, he said,
"If eating were an act as secret as the deed of darkness, or fugging, as they say in their sea jargon, would it be so obsessive, so omnipresent, the subject of almost all wit and mirth?"
Professor Graham, however, had moved almost to the very end of the ocean's empty wardroom, where he stood with his face by an open scuttle. And as Stephen approached, he limped swiftly towards the door, pausing there to say,
"Upon recollection, I find I'm compelled to decline the Worcester's wardroom's most polite and obliging invitation because of a previous engagement. You will present my best compliments and tell the gentlemen how much I regret not seeing them tomorrow."
"They will be disappointed, I am sure," said Stephen, "but there is always the oratorio. You will see them all at the oratorio on Sunday evening."
"On Sunday evening?" cried Graham. "Hech!
"How unfortunate! I fear I cannot reconcile it with my conscience to be present at a public exhibition or display on the Sabbath, not even a performance that is far from profane, and must beg to be excused."
Sunday evening came closer. Thursday, Friday, and on Saturday the Mistral, which had been blowing for 3 days, setting the squadron far to the south of its usual station, suddenly shifted several points and turned dirty, bringing black cloud and rain showers from the east-northeast.
"It will soon blow out,"
said the harmonious Worcesters as they gathered, necessarily under hatches, for their grand dress rehearsal. It had not been represented to them that neither costume nor action was usual in an oratorio, but as the sailmaker said,
"If we have no women to sing, we must have costumes. It stands to reason."
They certainly had no women, for the 3 or 4 warrant and petty officers' wives aboard were negligible quantities in the article of song. The oratorio was therefore strangely truncated, and the costumes were a matter of great concern to all the Worcester's people. Although ship visiting was discouraged in the squadron on blockade, a good deal of intercourse, in fact, took place. It was perfectly well known, for example, that the Orion, having pressed the male part of a bankrupt travelling circus, had a fire-eater aboard and 2 jugglers, amazing in calm weather, while the Canopus's weekly entertainments were always opened and closed by dancers that had appeared on the London stage. The Worcester passionately longed to wipe Orion's eye, as well as Canopus's, and since a large audience was expected, the Admiral having publicly, emphatically expressed his approval of the oratorio, it was absolutely essential that this audience should be struck all of a heap, and elegant, refined costumes were to do some of the striking. Unhappily, the victualler carrying the Aleppo muslin ordered from Malta was intercepted by a French privateer. It now adorned the whore ladies of Marseille, while Gibraltar sent nothing whatsoever, and the day came nearer with no elegant, refined costumes within 1,000 miles, and all the purser's duck irrevocably turned into common slops long since. The sailmaker and his mates, indeed the whole ship's company, began to look wistfully at the rarely used light and lofty sails, the kites, skyscrapers, royal and t'gallant stunsails. But the Worcester was a taut ship, a very taut ship. Her captain had already proved that he knew every last thing about Capybara, or the misappropriation of government stores, and with the squadron so short of everything and so far from sources of supply, it was impossible that he would tolerate even a modest degree of innocent theft. However, they sounded Mr. Pullings, who was obviously concerned with the success of the performance and the honour of the ship, and at the same time they made devious approaches to the captain by means of Bondon and Killick, to Dr. Maturin through a small black boy who acted as his servant, and to Mr. Mowat by ingenuous requests for advice as to how to proceed. The whole matter had therefore been present in Jack's mind, present in the atmosphere and with a favourable bias, well before he was called upon to make a decision. And the decision came out with all the directness that the seamen looked for. Any goddamned swab, any man that presumed to tamper with any sail, however thin, however worn in the bunt or chafed in the bands, should have his ears nailed to a 4-inch plank and be set adrift with 1/2 pound of cheese. On the other hand, there were 7 untouched bolts of No. 8 canvas, and if Sails and his crew liked to shape the cloths for a fair-weather suit of upper sails, that might do the trick. Sails did not seem to comprehend. He looked stupid and despondent.
"Come, Sails," said Jack. "How many 2-foot cloths do you need for a main royal?"
17 at the head and 22 at the foot, Your Honour."
"And how deep are they?"
7¼ yards, not counting the tapling or the gauze, which is all according."
"Why, then, there you are. You fold your cloth 4 times, tack a couple of grommets to each clue of the open ends, clap it over your shoulders 4 and aft, and there you are, in an elegant, refined costume in the classical taste, very like a toga, and all without cutting canvas or wronging the ship."
It was in these costumes, then, that they were gathered for the dress rehearsal, but although the togas were not a week old, they had already lost their classical simplicity. Many were embroidered, all had ribbons neatly sewn into the seams, and the general aim seemed to be to outdo Orion's feathers and tinsel as quickly as possible. The cooper and his friends had come out in gilded keg hoops by way of crowns. Yet although the choir looked a little strange, and would look stranger by far given time and leisure, they made a fine body of sound as they sang away, all crammed together below, with the deck touching the cooper's crown, the taller men's heads, but so deep in the music that the discomfort counted for nothing. In spite of the foul weather, Captain Aubrey heard them on the wind-swept, rain-swept, spray-swept quarter-deck. He was not an extremely amorous man. Hours or even days might pass without his thinking of women at all, but even so he had no notion of the eunuch's tranquillity, and although he did his duty, visiting the sick bay daily, and standing doggedly by the cases of mumps for 3 full minutes, he tended to avoid his friend Maturin, who wandered about in a most inconsiderate way, as though he did not mind spreading infection, as though it were all one to him if the entire ship's company piped like choir boys rather than roaring away in this eminently manly fashion, so that the Worcester's beams vibrated underfoot. He stood by the weather rail with his back to the rain, partly sheltered by the break of the poop, wearing a grigo with a hood pulled up, and he stared forward in the dim late afternoon light at the Orion, his next ahead on the larboard tack, as the squadron stood westward under close-reefed topsails with the wind 2 points free. Part of his mind was considering the effects of resonance and the harmonics of the hull, the singers being in rather than on the sound-box, while the rest concentrated upon the Worcester's mainmast. This massive piece of timber, 112 feet long and more than a yard across where it rose from the deck, complained every time the ship lifted to the short, steep seas under her larboard bow. Fortunately, there was no t'gallantmast aloft to add its leverage on the roll, nor any great press of canvas, but even so the mast was suffering. He would give it another preventer travelling backstay, and if that did not answer he would turn to his old caper of getting light hawsers to the mastheads, however uncouth it might look. But the whole ship was suffering, for that matter, not only the masts. The Worcester hated this particularly Mediterranean rhythm that caught her between two paces, as it were, so she could neither trot easy nor canter, but had to force her way through the sea with one reef more out of her topsails than her better-built companions, many of them from French or Spanish yards. Yet although hawsers might secure the masts, holding them even more strongly to the hull, if the Worcester did not mind looking lumpish and untidy, what measures could secure the hull itself? As Jack listened, below the oratorio, below the complaining of the masts, below the innumerable voices of the sea and the wind, right down to the deep, confused groaning of the timbers themselves, out of tune and unhappy, he reflected that if she could not be provided with new knees in the course of a thorough refit, he might eventually have to frap her whole carcass, winding cable round and round, until it looked like an enormous chrysalis. The idea made him smile, and smile all the wider, since the choir forward had worked their way to their favourite chorus, and were now topping it, the Covent Garden, with all their might, with infinite relish, too.
"Hallelujah!"
sang their captain with them as a fresh sheet of rain struck the ship, drumming on the back of his hood.
"Hallelujah!"
until an unmistakable gunshot to leeward cut his note short, and at the same moment the lookout hailed,
"Sail ho! Sail on the larboard quarter!"
Jack plunged across the deck to the lee rail, helped on his way by the Worcester's roll and lurch. Hammocks had not been piped up that soaking day, and there was no barrier between him and the sea to the southward. Yet nothing could he make out. He and Mowat, who had the watch, stood there searching the thick, grey squall of rain.
"Just abaft the mizzen backstay, sir,"
called Pullings from the maintop, where he too had been sheltering from Dr. Maturin. And the veil parting, both Jack and Mowat cried out,
"Surprise!"
Surprise she was, far to leeward, so far and so directly to leeward that with all her fine sailing qualities she could never hope to join the squadron for a great while. But it was clear that she meant the squadron to join her, for as they watched she fired another gun and let fly her topsail sheets. At this distance, and in this light, and with this wind, Jack could not make out the signal flying from her for masthead, but he had no doubt whatsoever of its meaning. The French fleet was out. The frigate's entire appearance and all her behaviour said so in the loudest voice. Her frightful press of sail, t'gallants in this close-reefed topsail breeze, her wild conduct with her sheets and guns, and now a blue light streaking away down the wind, could only mean one thing. The enemy was at sea, and the moment the signal reached the Admiral, the line would wear round onto the starboard tack and bear up for the surprise, to learn what more she might have to say.
"All hands to warship!"
he cried, and the signal midshipman, who had had the wit not to take his eyes from the brig, stationed outside the line to repeat signals from the almost invisible ocean, bawled,
"Flags to squadron, sir! We're in succession! Course southeast!"
over the roaring of the boatswain. Holler and his senior mate, who both loathed Handel, happened to be on the poop ladder at the moment of Jack's order. They now raced forward towards the unconscious choir, towards the vigorous crescendo, the one shouting,
"Rouse out, ye nightingales!"
and the other piping, "All hands wear ship!" with such force as almost to burst his silver call. Seconds later, in a strange, blank silence, the nightingales came flooding aft to their appointed stations. All the right sailors among them had discarded their togas, but a few of the landsmen had not, while the cooper still had his crown on his head. It so happened that his place was at the foresheet, and that two of the togaed figures clapped on just behind him. They were all men of slow comprehension, and they looked amazed, aggrieved, and so ludicrous that Jack laughed aloud, they being in his field of vision as he looked beyond them for the first movement of ocean's helm. His heart was bubbling high, that old splendid feeling of more, far more than common life. The ships bore down on the distant frigate, packing on more sail as they went, and the moment the Worcester was settled on her new course, Jack sent for the boatswain, desired him to lay along the long disused topgallant masts,
"We shall need 'em soon, Mr. Holler!"
and explained his wishes about light hawsers to the mastheads. These wishes were not entirely new to the service. It was known that Lord Cochrane and Captain Aubrey and one or two other commanders had achieved surprising feats with these same hawsers, but the service as a whole was dead against them as innovations, ugly, untidy innovations, worthy of privateersmen or even, God forbid, of pirates. It needed very great authority, or a peerage, or preferably both, to impose them on an old, experienced boatswain, and the surprise was quite near at hand before Holler moved off, at least outwardly convinced that the Worcester must disgrace herself in appearance, if, during the probable chase of the French fleet, she were not to disgrace herself in performance. The boatswain done with, Jack looked across the water at the surprise, and he observed with satisfaction that this was not a sea in which a boat could be launched, while the wind would make signalling slow and difficult. Word of mouth it would surely be, and those without scruples might perhaps overhear the exchange between the frigate and the flagship. The squadron heaved to. The surprise worked as close alongside the ocean as she dared, and delivered her information in a roar that could be heard by the ships, the openly listening ships, well ahead and astern. Latham, of the surprise, had a tremendous voice, and the captain of the fleet, speaking for the Admiral, an even louder one. But their brief conversation did not quite reach the Worcester. However, in this atmosphere of the utmost excitement, formality and even hard feeling went by the board, and as soon as the flag had signalled the new course, together with the order, "Make all sail with safety to the masts," Woodhouse of the Orion appeared at the taffrail of his ship and hailed Jack, poised on the Worcester's starboard cathead. The French were out, with 17 of the line, 6 of them 3-deckers, and with 5 frigates. They had still been steering south when Admiral Mitchell sent the surprise away in search of the squadron, while he continued dogging them in the San Joseph, detaching other messengers from time to time. From the greater zeal with which the French frigates had chased her to eastward, Surprise believed that the French fleet meant to go either to Sicily or right up the Mediterranean for Egypt or Turkey, but on being pressed admitted that this was little more than a guess.
"What is all this I hear about the French being out?" cried Stephen,
suddenly appearing on the crowded quarter-deck in the midst of the swaying up of the topgallant masts and the sending of hawsers aloft, two delicate, complex, dangerous manoeuvres that called for all the skilled hands in the ship, an immense quantity of ropes, thick and thin, and, in this strong breeze and awkward sea, very exact timing and instant obedience to orders. Stephen did not address himself directly to Captain Aubrey, who was standing by the windward hanses, his eyes fixed on the main topmast cross-trees, for that would have been improper. But Captain Aubrey had no such inhibitions, and instantly roared out,
"Go below, Doctor! Go below directly!"
Quite shocked by the vehemence of his cry, Stephen turned, but even as he turned, a party of seamen ran the stiff end of a cablet into his side, thrusting him under the fife-rail and calling out,
"By your leave, sir, by your leave!"
as they did so. And as he was disentangling himself from the belaying pins, he happened to loop a fancy line about his ankle and walk off with it, until his old friend Tom Pullings bawled,
"Stop playing with that fancy line and go below!"
with a ferocity that might have daunted Beelzebub. It was the edge of darkness before he ventured up again, and then only because of a kindly message. The captain's compliments, and if the doctor should wish to take the air, all was now cleared away and coiled down. There was air in plenty on deck. For the moment it was no longer mixed with rain, and it was coming in over the starboard rail even faster and in greater quantities than before. Jack shared the general belief that infection was far less to be dreaded in the open than between decks, and he invited Stephen over to the windward side. In any event, his mind was so eagerly aglow with life and the anticipation of battle, of a great decisive fleet action, that it had little time for disease.
"They are out, with 17 of the line," he said. "Give you joy of our prospects."
"Is there a real likelihood of our finding them? We are sailing towards the east, I see," said Stephen, nodding in the direction of the bloody remains of sunset on the Worcester's starboard bow.
"Westwards, I believe, if you will forgive me," said Jack. "It appears that the sun is usually found to set westerly, in the Mediterranean."
Stephen rarely suffered facetiousness patiently, but now he only said,
"West, I mean. Are you persuaded they have gone to the westward?"
"I hope so, indeed. Had they meant to go up the Mediterranean, I should have expected them to take some transports along. But according to surprise, there was nothing but men of war, and I am sure Latham took her in close enough to make certain. If we are wrong, and if they are destroying Sicily and our positions in the east while we are running west, there will be the devil to pay and no pitch hot. But I trust the Admiral. He thinks they are making for the Atlantic, and he has shaped a course to intercept them somewhere north of Cape Cavalaria."
"Do you think we shall do so? And if we do, can we attack 17 with no more than 12?
"I believe we may see them in the morning. Any squadron bound for the Straits with this wind is very likely to pass within 10 or 15 leagues of Cavalaria. And as for the odds," said Jack, laughing, "I am sure the Admiral would not give a damn if they were twice as great. Besides, there will be Mitchell in San Joseph, together with what he has left of the inshore squadron hanging on Emeriau's heels. No, if all goes as I hope it will go, we may bring them to action tomorrow."
"God send we may," said Stephen.
"A decisive action would clear the Mediterranean. We could go to America, and the Admiral could go home. Lord, how it would set him up! He would be a new man. So should I, for that matter. A decisive action, Stephen. It sets you up amazingly."
"It might stop the war," said Stephen. "A decisive victory at this point might stop the war. Tell me, why do not you—"
"Turn the glass and strike the bell," cried the quartermaster at the con. "Turn the glass and strike the bell it is," replied the marine, stepping forward to the belfry.
At the second stroke, a midshipman, wet from heaving the log, reported the ship's speed to the officer of the watch. He was followed by the carpenter, who reported the depth of water in the pump well. And each time Mr. Collins, the officer of the watch, paced across to Jack, took off his hat and repeated the information.
8 knots and 1 fathom, sir, if you please. 2 foot 11 inches in the well, sir, if you please, and gaining fast."
"Thank you, Mr. Collins," said Jack. "Pray let the forward pumps be shipped as well."
Nearly 3 foot of water down there already. It was 18 inches more than he had expected, although he knew that the ship had been working very heavily this last glass and more. They had already taken all the measures that could be taken at sea, and the only thing to do now was to pray that the chain pumps would not refuse their duty, though he might conceivably divert the stuffing box pump.
"I beg your pardon?" he said.
"Why do we go no faster? Sure, this is a respectable pace for a common voyage, but with such an end in view, should we not outstrip the wind, spread all sails we possess?"
"Well, the Admiral might take it amiss if we were to leave him behind. He lays down this rate of sailing so that even the slugs can just keep up. But what is much more to the point, what a set of clinch boots we should look, was we to raise Cavalaria before the French, always provided they come this way," he added, bowing to fate.
"But surely, surely," cried Stephen, "if you wish to stop an enemy, is it not best to throw yourself into his path, to be there first?"
"Oh, dear me, no," said Jack, "not at sea. It would never answer at sea. Why, if the wind were to stay true, and if we were to reach Cape Cavalleria first, we should be throwing away all the advantage of the weather gauge. Mr. Collins, we may come up the foresheet half a fathom, if you please.
He paced along the starboard gangway to the forecastle, gazing up at the sails, feeling the rigging. Holler, though an excellent boatswain in most respects, had a passion for smartness, for dead-straight shrouds and backstays, and whatever Jack might say, he would set up the standard rigging so iron-taut that the masts were in danger of being wrung. All was well at present, however. Poor Holler's pride had been brought so low by the hawsers to the mastheads that he had not taken his usual surreptitious heave at the lanyards, and the shrouds were reasonably pliant. The hawsers and the hairy cablets did indeed look heavy, lumpish, and untidy, with these Irish pennants all along, not perhaps unseamanlike, but something that no crack, spit-and-polish ship could bear for a moment. Yet, on the other hand, they did allow the Worcester to send up topgallant masts, without danger of rolling them by the board, and above all to carry a fair press of sail. She had the wind on her starboard quarter where she liked it best, and with her present trim she seemed to be running quite easy. But in fact she was still hauling under the chains, her seams opened on the upward roll and closed on the downward, and she was making much more water than she should. The main and forward pumps, turning steadily, were flinging two fine, thick jets to leeward. The Worcester usually pumped ship for at least an hour a day, even in calm weather, and all hands were thoroughly used to the exercise. The larboard watch had the deck at present, and as Jack made his tour he saw that they had not forgiven him for Barker. It was not that there was any deliberate want of respect, nor the least sign of discontent, far from it. The men were in high spirits at the notion of meeting the French fleet, full of fun in spite of the disappointment over the oratorio. But as far as Jack was concerned, there was a certain reserve. Intercourse between captain and lower deck was limited, even in an unrated vessel, with so small a crew that the commander knew each man intimately. There was no freedom of exchange, far less any flow of soul. In a ship of the line with above 600 hands, the apparent interchange was even less. Yet for those attuned to it, the language of eye, face, and bodily attitude is tolerably expressive, and Jack knew very well where he stood with those Worcesters who had not sailed with him before, the majority of the crew, and particularly of the larboard watch. It was a pity, since the ship's efficiency as a fighting machine was affected. But there was nothing he could do about it at this stage, and walking back to Stephen, he said,
"Sometimes I wonder whether I express myself clearly. Sometimes I wonder whether I make my meaning plain. I am not at all sure that you understand the weather gauge, even now."
"You have often mentioned it," said Stephen.
"Well, now," said Jack, "consider one line of battle to windward and another to leeward. It is clear that the ships to windward, those that have the weather gauge, can force the action and decide when it shall take place. They can bear down when they choose, and then again their smoke, going to leeward before them, hides them, which is a great point when you come within musket-shot. You must say that with a heavy sea running and a close-reefed topsail breeze, the windward ships cannot easily open their lower gun-ports as they come down, because they heel so, and that is profoundly true. But then, on the other hand, the squadron that has the weather-gauge can break the enemy's line."
"I am sure he can," said Stephen.
"For example, the Admiral could order every other ship to pass through, and so double up the Frenchman's van, two of ours engaging each one of his on either side, destroying or taking them before his rear division can come up, and then serving them the same way, not a single one to be left unsunk, unburnt, untaken. And you would fling all this away just for the satisfaction of being there first? It is rank treason."
"I only threw out the remark," said Stephen. "I am no great naval strategist."
"Sometimes I wonder whether you have really grasped that it is the wind alone that moves us. You have often suggested that we should charge to the right or the left, as the case might be, just as though we were flaming cavalry and could go where we chose. I wonder you have not improved your time at sea better. You have, after all, seen a certain amount of action."
"It may be that my genius, though liberal, is more of the land-born kind. But you are also to consider that whenever there is a battle, I am required to stay below stairs."
"Yes," said Jack, shaking his head. "It is very unfortunate. Very unfortunate indeed."
And in a gentler tone, he asked whether Stephen would like to hear of a battle, ideal in all its stages, remote approach, inception, prosecution, and termination, the kind of battle the squadron might engage in tomorrow if the Admiral had guessed right about the Frenchman's direction, and if the wind remained true.
For you must understand that everything, everything at sea depends on the wind.
I am fully persuaded of it, my dear, and should be happy to hear of our ideal encounter with Monsieur Emeriel.
Well, then, let us suppose that the wind holds true and that we have calculated our course and our speed correctly. I may say that Mr. Gill and I came to the same answer independently, give or take 2 miles, and that we have done the same for the French, which is probable, since they have 2 or 3 dull sailors with them, Robuste, Bourret, and maybe Lion, whose performance we know very well, and their squadron can sail no faster than the slowest. So we stand on all night in this loose formation, keeping our eyes fixed most religiously upon the Admiral's top-light when he hoists it, then at first light one of the frigates out ahead, and I do hope it will be dear surprise. Look, she is moving up to take her station now. She refitted at Cadiz, and they did wonders for her. Brand-new knees, stringers, cant pieces. How she flies!
She seems to be coming dangerously close to us, observed Stephen, having stared for a while.
I dare say Latham has thought of something witty to say about our hawsers and the Irish pennants. He has been peering at us through his glass this last hour and more, and cackling with his officers, said Jack. Lord, how he does crack on! She must be making a clear 13 knots off the reel. Look at the feather she throws, Stephen.
He gazed fondly at his old command as she came racing through the gloom, all white sails, white bow wave, white wake against the greyness. But the look of loving admiration vanished when she drew alongside, taking the wind out of the Worcester's sails and checking her pace with a started sheet, just long enough for Captain Latham to make an offer of his boatswain's services, in case Worcester should wish to deal with all those Irish pennants.
"From the look of your rigging, I should never have thought you had a single seaman aboard, let alone a boatswain," replied Jack with the full force of his lungs.
The Worcesters uttered a triumphant roar at this, and anonymous voices from open ports below begged to know whether they might favour surprise with any ewes, an obvious and wounding reference to a recent court-martial in which the frigate's barber was sentenced to death for bestiality.
"That settled Latham's hash, I believe," said Jack, with quiet satisfaction, as the surprise, having run out of wit, filled and shot ahead.
"What did he mean with his Irish pennants?" asked Stephen.
"Those untidy flakes and wefts of hemp on the hawsers. They would be intolerably slipshod in regular rigging. There, do you see? And there. We call them Irish pennants."
"Do you, indeed? Yet they are utterly unknown in Irish ships, and when they are perceived in others, they are universally termed Saxon standards."
"Call them what you like. They're damned ill-looking, uncouth objects, and I knew very well the squadron would laugh and come at it the satirical. But I will be buggered if I have a topmast carry away and so miss all the fun, and I will be damned if the Admiral throws out our signal to make more sail. And with a wall-sided, weak-kneed ship, what can you—" "There goes his top-light, by the way."
Jack cocked his ear to the poop. He heard the utterly reliable Pulling's voice say, "Bear a hand now, and wipe Orion's eye!" And the golden effulgence of the Worcester's 3 stern lanterns lit the mizzen topsail and the main course several seconds before those of any other ship in the squadron.
"You were telling me of your ideal battle with a view to illustrating naval strategy," said Stephen.
"Yes. The frigates tell us that the enemy is there under our lee, for the wind has stayed true, do you see, preferably straggling over a couple of miles of sea in 2 or 3 untidy heaps, as foreigners do, with the land no great way off to hamper their movements, and to make it even easier for Admiral Thornton to decide the moment for the action. My bet is that he will instantly make a dash for it, before they can form their line, bear down immediately, forming our own as we go, double on his weakest part, and so work up, taking, burning, or sinking as we go, for it will take them a great while to make an orderly line, whereas we do so every day, and we practice the manoeuvre from the dispersed positions at least 2 times a week. Every man will slip into his place, and since the Admiral has explained his plans for 6 situations, every man will know just what he is to do. There will be little signalling. The Admiral dislikes it, except in the greatest emergency, and the last time he spoke to the captains he said that if any one of us was puzzled or could not make out the order of battle because of the smoke, he might take it upon himself to engage the nearest Frenchman yard-arm to yard-arm.
But there are fewer of us, and since we must be able to compel a perhaps unwilling enemy to accept battle just when and where it suits us, all this, you understand, depends on our having the weather gauge. That is to say, that the wind shall blow from us to them. Lord Stephen, I shall not be satisfied with anything under 20 prizes, and a dukedom for the Admiral.
Sure, I take your point about the wind, said Stephen in a sombre voice. Although he longed for the final overthrow and destruction of Bonaparte and his whole system, the immediate prospect of huge slaughter depressed him extremely. Apart from anything else, his duties during battle and after it brought him to be intimately acquainted with war's most hideous side, and with young men maimed. He did not mention this, however, but after a pause he asked,
20? That is more than Monsieur Emeriard has with him.
Jack had named the impossible number by way of conjuring fate. In fact, he expected a very severe encounter indeed, for although from want of keeping the sea the French were often slow in manoeuvring, their gunnery was sometimes deadly accurate, and their ships were solid, well-found, and new. But he was aware of what was in his friend's mind, and he was about to pass his 20 off as a slip of the tongue, when the Renown, quarter of a mile away on the Worcester's starboard bow, hoisted a string of coloured lanterns to tell the Admiral that she was overpressed with sail.
"Overpressed with sail," said Jack, "and she will not be the only one. We shall see a good many t'gallants gone in the morning, if the breeze keeps freshening like this, working up an ugly sea."
"It is shockingly rough indeed. Even I have to cling on with both hands," said Stephen.
And as he spoke, a packet of mixed water and froth struck the side of his face, running down inside his shirt. He considered for a while, and added,
"Poor Graham will be in a sad way. He has not yet learnt the lithe, gliding motion of the seaman. He has not learnt to anticipate the billow's force."
"Perhaps you should turn in, Stephen. You may need all your strength tomorrow. I will have you called the moment the French fleet is seen, never fear. I promise you shall miss nothing."
Yet the sun rose, and no one woke Dr. Maturin. A thin, grey, damp light straggled down to the cabin where he swung in his damp cot, dripped or even squirted upon each time the Worcester rolled, and still he lay, almost comatose, after 8 sleepless, tossing hours, and then at last a small glass of laudanum. A more than usually violent lee-lurch sent a positive jet of water through the ship's side as her timbers opened and closed under the strain, and the jet, striking him in the face, plucked him from a dream of whales into the present world, and he woke with a confused sense of extreme urgency. Sitting up and clinging to the lengths of baize-covered man-rope that had kindly been provided for his getting in and out, he raised his voice in a grating howl, his nearest approach to the all-pervading sea-officer's call for his servant. Nothing happened. Perhaps his hail had been drowned by the omnipresent noise of grinding timber, pounding seas, and roaring wind. He said, "Damn the booby!" and hurried into his damp breeches, tucking his wet nightshirt about him. He groped his way to the empty wardroom, and there he hailed the wardroom steward. But again he hailed in vain. Empty it was, the long table stretching away with fiddles upon it holding a few empty bowls, while the bread barge glided up and down as the Worcester pitched. The wardroom kept a barrel of small beer slung from the after beams for those who liked it, and Stephen, dry within though damp without, was wondering whether the draught would be worth the journey, when the Worcester plunged her stern deep into her own wake, so that he was obliged to crouch to keep his balance. There followed a quivering pause, during which he considered small beer, and then the forward part of her hull crashed down into a hollow of the sea with such extraordinary and quite unexpected violence that Stephen turned a double backward somersault, miraculously landing on his feet, quite unhurt.
"That was why I was dreaming of whales, no doubt, of the ship diving upon whales," he reflected as he climbed the companion ladder and put his head above the rim of the quarter-deck. A rough, blowing, overcast day, he saw, with spray and packets of solid water flying through the air. A grim quarter-deck, with almost all the officers and young gentlemen upon it looking grave, and a strong party at the pump by the mainmast, turning the winches fast, with reliefs standing by.
Jack and Pullings, over on the weather side, obviously discussing something high among the sails.
Even if Jack had not been so obviously engaged, Stephen would not have approached him.
The captain of the Worcester never allowed his young gentleman to appear improperly dressed, and he expected his officers to set a good example. He was himself rosy with new shaving, although from his drawn face he had certainly not been to bed at all. Nor had a good many other people, Stephen could see, and from their grey, jaded looks it appeared to him that both watches had been on deck all night. There was obviously some grave emergency, for one of the oldest, most strictly observed of all naval rules required that those who attended to the officer's comfort should never, never be called away unless instant dissolution threatened. Yet here before him, at the camp winches, or waiting their turn, stood his own servant, the wardroom steward, Killick himself, and the captain's cook. Eager to know more, he crammed his nightcap into a pocket, passed his hand over his bristly skull by way of making himself more presentable, and climbed the remaining steps, with the intention of sidling along behind the midshipmen to the leeward beak of the poop, where the purser, a great tactician, was evidently explaining the situation to Stephen's two assistants and the captain's clerk. But again he had reckoned without the Worcester's strange, surprising capers. He was on the rim itself, bending forward, when the ship dropped her bows sideways into the long vacancy, making that same monstrous jerk and crash, and bowling him diagonally across the deck to his captain's feet.
"Bravo, Doctor!" cried Jack. "You could set up for a tumbler, if all else fails. But you have no hat, I see. You have forgot your hat. Mr. Seymour," he called out to a midshipman, "jump to my forecabin for the spare foul-weather hat by the barometer, and read the glass as you bring it away."
28 inches and 1/16, sir, if you please," said Mr. Seymour, passing the hat, "and sinking still." Jack clapped the hat on Stephen's head, Pullings fastened the tapes under his chin, and together they propelled him to the rail.
"But there they are," he burst out, his voice cracking with emotion. "There they are, for all love."
And there they were indeed, the long line of French men of war covering a mile of torn, white-whipped sea, the rearmost division somewhat separated from the rest and not much above 2 miles from the English ships.
"Give you joy of your prophecy, Jack," he cried,
but the words were hardly out before he wished them back, for the essence of the prophecy was not there. The strong, gusty wind was blowing from the enemy line, and not towards it, and that was the reason for the look of cruel, long-drawn-out disappointment on his friend's face. Emeriau it was who had the weather gauge, and he was making use of it to go home, declining battle. The wind had veered steadily throughout the night, falling to a near calm in the middle watch, and then suddenly springing up again and blowing harder from the northwest, so that although they found the French fleet off Cape Cavalleria as they had hoped, the whole situation was reversed. The enemy were now steering for home with the wind 1 point free, while the English line, close-hauled, crowded sail in the hope, the very faint hope, of cutting off the rear division.
"The trouble is, being new and clean, they sail so much better on a bowline than we do with our foul bottoms and old ships," said Jack. "But we still have a chance. The wind may back and favour us. It has often shifted these last hours, and they have the indraught and the Cavalleria current to contend with."
"What is that frightful noise? That great resounding crash?"
"We call it slapping. Some of our northern ships do it when they stem these short, hollow seas. It makes the Mediterranean builders laugh."
"Perilous, would it be, at all?" Jack whistled.
"Why, as long as we do not spring a butt, we're not likely to founder," he said. "But it does make things a little damp between decks, and it does check our speed. Now you must forgive me. You would get a better general view from the poop. Mr. Grimmond, Mr. Savage, give the doctor a hand to the poop. He would like to sit on the combing, where he can clap on to the fife-rail if it should get rough. Forecastle there! Is that spritsail topsail laid along?"
He returned to the task of driving a heavy, partially waterlogged and possibly disintegrating ship through a savage, chaotic cross-sea, the Mediterranean at its sudden worst, and all the time he tried to persuade himself that the rearmost Frenchmen were not drawing away. The English line had changed a good deal since it was first formed at crack of dawn, and the Worcester had moved up 2 places, the Orion dropping astern for want of a foot-to-gallant mast, and then the Renown with her bowsprit gone in the gammoning. The squadron was now sailing in a bow-and-quarter line, pelting along as hard as ever they could go, all their carefully husbanded stores, cordage, sailcloth, and spars now laid out with a reckless prodigality. Jack could see the Admiral, made fast to an elbow chair clamped to the ocean's quarter-deck, his telescope often trained forward to fix Emerial's flagship. Little time he had for watching the Admiral, however. This pace, close-hauled on a strong but capricious and veering wind, that might lay the Worcester on her beam ends with a sudden, furious gust, or take her aback, called for the closest attention. And all this time the four experienced quartermasters at the wheel had to favour her to try to avoid the murderous slap, but without losing speed. From his lonely, wind-swept, comfortless viewpoint abaft the mizzenmast, Stephen could make out little but a confused turmoil of water, high, sharp-pointed waves apparently running in every direction, a dirty sea with a great deal of yellowish foam blown violently over the surface, eddying here and there, and all this beneath a low, yellow-grey sky with lightning under the western clouds. Far more impressive seas he had known. The enormous rollers of the high southern latitudes, for example, of the hurricane waters off Mauritius. But he had not seen a more wicked and, as it were, spiteful sea, with its steep, close-packed waves, a sea that threatened not the instant annihilation of the great Antarctic monsters, but a plucking apart, a worrying to death. Looking along the line, he saw that several of the English ships had already been plucked to some degree. Many a t'gallant mast was gone, and even to his unprofessional eye there seemed to be some strange makeshift spars, sails, and rigging, while far astern one unhappy ship could be seen sending up a jury mizzen, and at the same time trying everything humanly possible to keep pace. Yet there was not a ship but that was hurrying, racing along, with a prodigious expenditure of nautical skill and ingenuity and persistence, as though joining battle were the only felicity, a battle that seemed more and more improbable as time went by, measured for Stephen by the regular strokes on the Worcester's bell, and for the seamen by one emergency after another. The main pump choking, a gun breaking loose on the lower deck, the foretopsail blowing clean out of its bolt rope. At four bells, Dr. Maturin, changing into his old crusted black coat, crept down to make his rounds of the sick bay. This was earlier than his usual time, but it was rare that a heavy, prolonged blow did not bring a fair number of casualties, and in fact the sick bay was busier than he had expected. His assistants had dealt with many of the sprains, contusions, and broken bones, but some they had left for him, including a striking, complex compound fracture recently brought below.
"This will take us until after dinner, gentlemen," he said. "But it is much better to operate while he is unconscious. The muscles are relaxed, and we are not distracted by the poor fellow's screams."
"In any case, there will be nothing hot for dinner," said Mr. Lewis. "The galley fires are out."
"They say there are 4 feet of water in the hold," said Mr. Dunbar.
"They love to make our flesh creep," said Stephen. "Come, pledgets, ligatures, the leather-covered chain, and my great double-handed retractor, if you please, and let us stand as steady as we can, bracing ourselves against these uprights."
The compound fracture took even longer than they had expected, but eventually he was sewn up, splinted, bandaged, and lashed into a cot, there to swing until he was cured. Stephen hung his bloody coat to drip dry upon its nail and walked off. He looked into the wardroom, saw only the purser and two of the marine officers wedged tight about their bottle, and returned to his place on the poop, carrying a tarpaulin jacket. As far as he could make out, little had changed. The Worcester and all the ships he could see ahead and astern were still tearing along at the same racing speed, carrying a great press of canvas and flinging the white, broken water wide, a great impression of weight, power, and extreme urgency. On the decks below him there was still the same tension, with men jumping to make the innumerable slight changes that Jack called for, from the place at the weather rail that he had scarcely left for 5 minutes since the chase began, and where he was now eating a piece of cold meat. The pumps were still turning fast, and somewhere in the middle parts of the ship another had joined them, sending its jet in a fine curve far out to leeward. The French line still stretched halfway to the horizon, standing northeast for Toulon. They did not seem very much farther away, if at all, and it seemed to Stephen that this might continue indefinitely. To be sure, the Worcester was labouring cruelly, but she had been labouring cruelly for so long that there seemed no good reason why she should not go on. He watched attentively, therefore, and not without hope that some disaster among the French ships might allow the squadron to make up those few essential miles. He watched, fascinated by the spectacle of what he was tempted to call motionless, relatively motionless, hurry, with a sense of a perpetual frozen present, unwilling to miss anything until well on into the afternoon when Mowat joined him.
"Well, Doctor," said he, sitting wearily on the combing, "we did our best."
"Is it over, sir?" cried Stephen. "I am amazed, amazed!"
"I'm amazed it lasted so long. I never thought to see her take such a pounding and still swim. Look at that," he said, pointing to a length of caulking that had worked out of a seam in the deck. "God love us, what a sight! She spewed the oakum from her sides long since, as you would have expected with such labouring, but to see it coming from amidships seam—"
"Is that why we must give up?"
"Oh, no, it is the breeze that fails us."
"Yet there seems to be a good deal still," said Stephen, looking at the strip of mixed pitch and oakum as it lashed to and fro in the wind, the end shredding off in fragments that vanished over the side.
"But surely you must have seen how it has been hauling forward this last hour. We shall be dead to leeward presently. That is why the Admiral is taking his last chance. You did not notice the Doris repeating his signal, I suppose?"
"I did not. What did it signify?"
"He is sending our best sailors in to attack their rear. If they can get there before the wind heads them, and if Emeriau turns to support his ships, he hopes we shall be able to come up in time to prevent ours being mauled."
"A desperate stroke, Mr. Mowat?"
"Well, sir, maybe, maybe. But maybe it will bring on a most glorious action before the sun goes down. Look, here they come. San Joseph, Berwick, Sultan, Leviathan, and just the two frigates to windward, no, sir, to windward, Pomony, and of course our dear old Surprise. All French or Spanish ships, you see, and all with a fine tumble home. Some fellows have all the luck. I will fetch you a spyglass, so that you miss nothing." Now that they were no longer obliged to keep down to the squadron's pace, the four swift-sailing ships of the line ran up in splendid style, steadily increasing sail as they came. They passed up, forming as they went, and each ship gave them a brief, informal, spontaneous cheer as they went by. Stephen saw the cheerful Rear Admiral Mitchell in the San Joseph, the surgeon of the Leviathan, and perhaps a dozen other men he knew, all looking as though they were going to a treat. And he waved to Mr. Martin, on the Berwick's quarter-deck, but Mr. Martin, half blinded by the spray sweeping aft from the Berwick's eager bow, did not see the signal. Now they were well ahead, the San Joseph leading, the others in her wake, and all heading straight for the gap between the French rear and centre divisions. Stephen watched them closely with his glass. The finer points of seamanship no doubt escaped him, yet he did see that for the first hour they not only drew clear away from their friends, but they certainly gained on their enemies. For the first hour. Then between three bells and four, the situation hardly changed. All those heavily armed, densely populated ships raced strenuously over the sea in gratuitous motion, neither gaining nor losing. Or was there indeed a loss, a slackening of the tension, the first edge of sickening disappointment? Stephen peered over the poop rail down at the quarter-deck, where Jack Aubrey stood in his set place as though he were part of the ship. But little did he learn from that grave, closed, concentrated face. At that point the Worcester's captain was in fact even more part of his ship than usual. The masters, carpenters, first lieutenants' reports had given him a fairly clear picture of what was happening below, and intuition provided the rest. He felt each of her monstrous plunges as though her bowels were his own. Furthermore, he knew that the immense purchases by which he had so far held the Worcester's masts to her hull depended essentially upon the mechanical strength of her clamps and hanging knees, that these must be near their limit, and that if they went he could not carry half his present sail, could not keep up with the squadron, but would have to fall to leeward with the other lame ducks. For a long while he had prayed that they might last long enough for the fighting to begin in the French rear, and for the Worcester to come up. Now, keener sighted than his friend, he saw that there was to be no fighting. Long before Stephen saw the San Joseph taken squarely aback, losing her main t'gallant mast with the shock, Jack realized that Mitchell's ships were being headed by the wind. He had seen the quivering weather leeches, he had divined the furious bracing of the yards and the hauling of the bowlines, and he had measured the increasing gap between the English and the French. and it was clear to him that the advanced ship's slanting approach to the enemy could not succeed, that the long chase must end in slow disappointment and anticlimax. But it was not over yet.
"Look at Surprise and Pomony, sir!"
cried Pullings, and swinging his telescope from the San Joseph, Jack saw the two frigates draw ahead under a great press of sail and bear down under the rearmost Frenchman's lee, the Robuste, of 80 guns. They moved faster than any ship of the line, and as soon as they were within range they opened with their bow guns and then with their broadsides, firing high in the hope of knocking away some important spar.
"Luff up! Luff up, for God's sake, luff up!"
said Jack aloud, as he followed them in their perilous course along the Robuste's side. Very close range was everything in such a case. But neither Surprise nor Pomony luffed up. Both sides fired repeatedly at a distance. Neither did any apparent damage, and after the frigate's first unsuccessful run, Admiral Thornton threw out the signal of recall, emphasizing it with 2 guns. An engagement at that range, a distant peppering, would accomplish nothing, whereas the Robuste's heavy metal might disable or even sink the smaller ships. And these 2 guns, together with those remote and ineffectual broadsides under the clouds to the northeast, were all the firing the squadron ever heard. Almost immediately after the Admiral's 2nd gun, and as though in answer to it, a particularly violent gust laid the Worcester over in a cloud of foam. She recovered heavily, all hands clinging to their holds, but as she came up and took the weather strain, so Jack heard the deep, internal rending that he had dreaded. He and Pullings exchanged a glance. He stepped over to his larboard hawsers, felt their horrible slackness, and called to the signal midshipman,
"Mr. Savage, prepare the hoist. I am overpressed with sail."
Chapter 9. When Jack Aubrey brought his ship into the fleet at the rendezvous southeast of Toulon, she had 3 turns of 12-inch cable frapped about her, and a spare spritsail thick with tarred oakum drawn under her bottom. She had something of the chrysalis look her captain had once imagined in the lightness of his heart, but at least she still possessed her masts and all her guns, though they had cost her people some cruel days of pumping, and at least she looked trim and clean as she glided cautiously in over a perfect sea, the deep, deep blue rippling under the caress of a languid southern breeze. The water still gushed in steady jets from her side, but she was no longer in danger of foundering. The Worcester came in at such a gentle pace that Jack had plenty of time to survey the squadron. Some ships were missing, either because they had been sent to Malta to refit, or because they had not yet rejoined. But on the other hand, 2 74s and an 80-gun ship had arrived from Cadiz, and at least some stores must have reached the fleet, since there were now only 6 jury-masts to be seen. The squadron, though battered and somewhat diminished, was still a powerful blockading force. He saw that, clearly enough, from a distance, and when his barge pulled along the line in answer to the flagship's signal, he saw it more clearly still. On this calm, sunny day, the ships all had their ports open to air the lower decks, and behind these ports he saw the guns, row after row of guns, with seamen titivating them. This sense of abiding strength and his exact falling in with a squadron was a satisfaction to him, but the greater part of his mind was taken up with foreboding and concern. As the barge slipped along past the ocean's splendid gilded stern, he heard the howling of the Admiral's little dog, and when Bondon hooked on at the entry port, blundering for the first time in his life as captain's coxswain, Jack was obliged to compose himself for an instant before going aboard. The ceremony of reception was muted. On all hands he saw faces as grave as his own, and the Admiral's secretary, leading him to the forecabin, said in a low voice, "When I take you in, pray let the interview be as short and smooth as possible. He has had a long, hard day of it. Dr. Harrington is with him now." They stood there for a while, looking out through the half-port, beyond the dark rectangle, to the brilliance and purity of the day, even purer and more brilliant for being framed. And still the dog howled.
"The doctor is with him," reflected Jack. "So they have put the pug into the coach. Some dogs cannot bear seeing their masters touched."
The ocean veered 1/4 of a point, and now the frame contained a ship,
a great way off and apparently floating above the nacreous surface of the farther sea. As seamen will, Jack tilted his head back and sideways to consider her. She was surprise, of course, and she was presumably coming from the inshore squadron. Yet her side was painted blue, and what little he could make out of her pennant showed it as low as the cross-trees. The ship was in mourning.
"What has happened to Captain Latham?" he asked.
"Can you indeed see as far as that?" said Alan, following his gaze. "I'm afraid he was killed. He and his first lieutenant were killed by the same ball as the Surprise was going down to attack the Robuste." Dr. Harrington came out of the great cabin, bowed and somber. He opened the coach door as he went by, and the little dog, scrambling fast across the deck, darted in before Jack and the secretary and flung itself down under the admiral's desk. Jack had expected to find the admiral deeply saddened, even more infirm, possibly savage. He could be a Tartar on occasion, certainly very gravely affected indeed, but he had not expected to find him removed from humanity, and it disconcerted him. Admiral Thornton was perfectly civil and collected. He congratulated Aubrey on having brought the Worcester in, listened to a brief summary of the statement of condition that Jack laid on his desk, and said the ship must clearly go to Malta for a complete refit. She would be of no use as a man of war for a great while, if at all, but her guns would be uncommonly useful at this juncture. His mind was alive. It dealt with the details of his command, rarely hesitating for a moment, but the man was not, or not wholly, and he looked at Jack from an immense distance, not coldly, still less severely, but from another plane, and Jack felt more and more embarrassed, ashamed of being alive while the other was already taking leave.
"But in the meantime, Aubrey," said the admiral, "you will not be idle. As you may have heard, poor Latham was killed in his engagement with the Robuste, so you will proceed to the Seven Islands in Surprise. The death of one of the Turkish rulers on the Ionian coast has brought about a complex situation that may possibly allow us to expel the French from Marga, even from Paxo and Corfu, and we must have at least one frigate on the spot. I will not elaborate. I am leaving this station very shortly, you know. But Mr. Allen will make the position clear, and the Rear Admiral will give you your orders. You will have the advice of Dr. Maturin and Mr. Graham. Does that suit you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then goodbye to you, Aubrey," said the admiral, holding out his hand. Yet it was not a human farewell. It was rather a gesture of civility to a being of another kind, very small and far away, at the wrong end of a telescope, as it were, a being of no importance, in circumstances of no great importance, that nevertheless had to be dealt with correctly. Only twice had Jack felt that the admiral was still in contact with the ordinary world. Once, when he gently put his foot on the pug's back to stop it wheezing so loud, and once when he said, "Leaving this station?" It was common knowledge that the ocean was sailing for Mahon and Gibraltar in the morning, but the admiral's meaning would have been clear to a man with even less religious sense than Jack Aubrey, and the tone of unaffected humility and resignation moved him deeply. Returning to the fore cabin, he found Stephen there with Mr. Allen and Professor Graham.
"Captain Aubrey," said Stephen, "I have been telling Mr. Allen that I must decline going with you to Admiral Hart's apartment. There are circumstances that make it improper for me to make any official appearance in this matter, or in any other to do with intelligence at present."
"I quite agree," said Graham.
"Besides," added Stephen, "I have to see Dr. Harrington and our patient in 15 minutes.
"Very well," said Alan. "Then I shall send a messenger to tell Dr. Harrington that you are here. Gentlemen, shall we wait on the Rear Admiral?"
Rear Admiral Hard had never held an independent command of any importance, and the prospect of supporting the enormous responsibilities of Commander-in-Chief in the Mediterranean overwhelmed him. Although it was certain that the Admiralty would not leave him in a post so very far beyond his abilities, but would send out a replacement as soon as the news of Admiral Thornton's incapacity reached London, Hart's manner and even his appearance were almost unrecognizable. His ill-looking, foxy, close-eyed face wore a look that Jack had never seen on it before,
although they were old, old acquaintances, a look of earnest gravity. He was civil to Jack and almost deferential to Alan and Graham, who for their part treated him with no extraordinary respect. Hart had at no time been admitted to the Admiral's confidence in anything but purely naval matters. He knew almost nothing of the deeply involved political situation, and nothing whatsoever about the Admiral's frail network of intelligence. Alan gave a short account of the position in the Seven Islands, and Hart could be seen straining his weak understanding to follow it.
"Now, sir," said Alan, "I advert not to the Seven Islands as such, but to their former allies and dependencies on the mainland, particularly Kutali and Marga. As you know, the French are still in Marga, and they seem to be as firmly settled there as they are in Corfu. Yet a little while ago it was represented to the Commander-in-Chief that the possessor of Kutali could cut Marga's aqueduct and take the town from behind, while a friendly base at Kutali would make it far easier for us to attack Paxo and Corfu, which even Bonaparte calls the keys of the Adriatic."
"We are to take Kutali, then?" said Hart.
"Why, no, sir," said Alan patiently. "Kutali is Turkish, and we must not offend the Porte. Any evident, unprovoked aggression in this region would give our enemies in Constantinople a great advantage. It must never be forgotten that the French have some very intelligent men there, that the Sultan's mother is a Frenchwoman, and that Napoleon's recent successes have very much strengthened the French party. But it so happens that the town, which, as you will recall, was an independent Christian republic before the Treaty of Pressburg, lies between three ill-defined beyliks, and its status has not yet been finally decided in Constantinople. The former governor, whose recent death brought this crisis about, was to hold office only while the town's position, its privileges, and so on, were considered. It is a valuable place. The neighbouring rulers covet it exceedingly, and two of them, Ismail and Mustafa, have already approached us for help, while the agent of the third is thought to be in Malta at present."
"What kind of help do they want?" asked Hart.
"Guns, sir, and gunpowder."
"Guns!"
cried Hart, looking at the others. But he said no more. And when first Alan and then Graham explained that in the outlying provinces of the Turkish Empire the Valis, Pashas, Agas, and Beys, though in principle subject to the Sultan, often behaved like independent rulers, increasing their territories by usurpation or by making open war upon one another, he looked displeased.
"Ali Arslan of Yanina defeated and killed the Pasha of Scutari not long since," said Graham. "It is true that Scutari had rebelled, but the same cannot be said for the Derwent Pasha of Rumelia, nor of Minoglu Bey."
"The independence increases with the distance from Constantinople," said Alan. "In Algiers, for example, it is virtually complete, but here it is usually exercised with a certain discretion. They often go to war with one another, but they generally do so with cries of loyalty to the Sultan, for although the Porte will acquiesce in a fait accompli if it is accompanied by the proper offerings, a reasonably good case still has to be made out. The defeated man must be shown to have had treacherous intentions or to have been in correspondence with the enemy."
"And except in cases where the Pasha or Vali throws off his allegiance and goes about to cut himself out a completely sovereign state, as Scutari and Pasanvoglu did not long ago, and as Ali Pasha will almost certainly do as soon as he can be sure of the Moria, except in cases of total rebellion, I say, the Sultan's direct appointment is respected in these parts, when at last it is forthcoming in the form of an irade, or firman," said Graham. "The Sultan's irade is sacred except to rebels."
"That is why all three beys also have their agents busy in Constantinople, jockeying for position," said Alan, "though to be sure they expect to settle matters much more briskly by themselves, so that the fact of possession and the increased wealth of possession may plead in their favour. Unfortunately, one of them has also seen fit to make interest with our embassy, which may complicate our task. For whereas the Commander-in-Chief inclines towards Mustafa as a seaman and a former acquaintance, they knew one another when Mustafa was in the Dardanelles, the embassy favours Ismail."
"Who holds the place at present?" asked Jack.
"The third man, old Sayahan Bey. That is to say, he is sitting quietly in the lower town and the suburbs. The Christians, the Kutaliotes, hold the citadel unmolested. For the moment there is an uneasy truce, no one of the three Turks daring to attack for fear of meeting a coalition of the other two, and the Christians biding their time.
but the position will change the moment the cannon arrive. Hart stared for a while, and then said,
"So they mean to fight one another, and we are to supply the guns. What do the various sides offer in exchange?"
"Their promises are the same. They will turn the guns against the French in Marga. Having settled us in Kutali, they will join in our attack on Marga, the place being taken before there is time for the French party in Constantinople to interfere."
"I see. Are the guns available?"
"Yes, sir. Two small transports have been prepared and are lying in Valletta. The trouble is we do not know which of the claimants to trust. Ismail openly states that General Donzelot, the commander of Corfu, has made him offers, but this may merely be intended to raise his price. Mustafa says nothing of the kind, but we have a certain amount of intelligence to show that he too may be in contact with the French. So bearing these things in mind, sir, and taking into account the necessity for rapid action, it was thought advisable to send Captain Aubrey with a political adviser to view the situation, to meet the Beys, to make up his mind on the spot, and, if possible, to carry out the operation."
"Just so," said Hart.
"Perhaps it would be as well to couch the orders in the most general sense, leaving a great deal of room for discretion?"
"Certainly, certainly. Just put, use his best endeavours, together with a general statement of the aim of the operation, and leave it at that. Do not tie his hands. Does that suit you, Aubrey?"
"If it don't, just say the word, and the orders shall be wrote to your dictation. I can't say fairer than that." Jack bowed, and there was a short silence.
"Then there is this point of the surprises crew, sir," said Alan. "In view of the death of Captain Latham and his first lieutenant, the commander-in-chief thought you would agree that the best way of dealing with the situation would be to disperse the entire ship's company in small groups throughout the squadron, and reman the frigate from the ships that have to go in to refit."
"God damn me," said Hart. "I should hang them, mutinous buggers, if I had my own way, every last one of them. But with both chief witnesses dead, I suppose it must be so." "Since Worcester must go in," said Jack, "I could pick an excellent frigate's crew from her people alone, men who are used to working together. Several old surprises among them."
"Make it so, Aubrey. Make it so," said Hart. And in the same tone of awkward goodwill, he continued,
"Of course, you will have to have a sloop of some kind in company for this sort of expedition. If you like, I will try to let you have Babington in the Dryad." "Thank you very much, sir," said Jack. "I should like that of all things." "I should like that of all things," said I, with a winning leer and a bob of my head, wrote Jack Aubrey in his letter home, a letter dated from Surprise at Sea. "But I hope, sweetheart, you will not think me ungenerous or mean-spirited when I say I do not trust him. That is to say, I do not trust the long continuance of his goodwill. If I choose the wrong man among these Beys, or if the operations do not go well, I think he will throw me to the dogs without the least hesitation, and William Babington after me. Stephen don't trust him neither."
He paused, and reflecting that he could not very well describe his friend's vehement refusal to appear in the character of an intelligence agent before
a man so weak, so choleric, so little master of his passions, and so likely to be indiscreet as Hart, even though the Rear Admiral might for the moment be acting Commander-in-Chief, he added,
"Which is very sad."
But the words were no sooner written than they struck him as ludicrous, and he was so very far from sad himself that he laughed aloud.
"What now?" called Killick angrily from the sleeping cabin.
He was one of the very few who disliked the move into the Surprise, and he had been in a most unpleasant temper ever since they left Malta. His immediate predecessor, Captain Latham's steward, a fornicating sodomite by the name of Hogg, had changed everything. Nothing was the same. The night locker, where Killick had always kept needle and thread for small repairs, had been moved from starboard to larboard. The midship's scuttle, under which he had always worked, had been blocked up and painted over. He could no longer find anything, nor could he see to sew.
"I was only laughing," said Jack.
"If I had that hog under my needle now," said Killick, giving the hem of Captain Aubrey's best neckcloth a vicious stab, "wouldn't I learn him to laugh? Oh, no, not off, I wouldn't."
His voice diminished in volume, but his nasal whine had a curiously penetrating quality, and as Jack carried on with his letter, he half heard the stream of discontent flowing on.
"Unhappy ship! No wonder. Everything changed. Acres of fucking brass. Closed up my scuttle.
How can a poor unfortunate bugger see with no light, sowing black upon black?
This last was so shrill that it quite broke in upon Jack's line of thought.
If you cannot see in there, carry it out into the stern gallery, he called,
forgetting for a moment that they were no longer in the Worcester.
Which there ain't no stern gallery, sir, now we've been degraded to a sixth rate, cried Killick with malignant triumph. Stern galleries is for our bitches, and I must toil and moil away in the dark.